Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor. In 1975, a fledgling think tank called the Institute for Fiscal Studies created a committee to re-examine the British tax system. The man charged with the job was promptly given the Nobel Prize. His two assistants went on to become Mervyn King, the Governor of the Bank of England, and John Kay, our guest today on the CapEx podcast. John went on to run the Institute for Fiscal Studies, building it into the most respected outfit in economic analysis. He founded the Oxford Business School. He's taught at Oxford and at London. He's been a commentator for the Financial Times for many years. And I guess is probably one of the leading champions and critics of the free market in Britain. He's one of the people you turn to understand why the market is a good thing and also where it's going wrong.
Yeah, I think that's an introduction I very much like, apart from the flattery, because saying that markets are, in an obvious sense, the only game in town, that all successful, prosperous economies have been, in a loose sense, market economies. But there are different kinds of market economy. What we mean by a market economy is not that clear. And the kind of what has become caricatured, well, people in favour of it have caricatured it, in effect, as you should encourage people to be extremely greedy and allow them to do whatever they like. That isn't actually an economic system that works. In fact, the countries which really are like that, Nigeria, as it were, are not exemplars of what economic effectiveness and prosperity is about. Markets operate in a social context, and unless we understand that, we understand very little.
Yes, because, I mean, the sort of narrative in politics at the moment is essentially that the public has lost faith in markets. That new polling suggests that they'd happily nationalise the banks, the energy companies. They don't understand why private firms should run things. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's party conference speech was essentially a 5,000-word paean to the joys of state direction. He was saying, things like automation is a great challenge, and the only way that we can cope with it is to have it guided and managed and controlled by the public.
It is strange, isn't it, that we are where we are in part because of the failures of that kind of approach in the 20, 30 years after the war. And I was very struck that, if you look at the leaders of the new radical left in major countries, you have Bernie Sanders in the United States, born 1943, Jeremy Corbyn, born 1958, Mélenchon in France, born 1951. Sometimes I look at Jeremy Corbyn, and I think he thinks what I thought when I was 17 is just I've learned a bit since then.
Yes,
and he hasn't.
I mean, reading, it's astonishing. If you read Bernie Sanders, I've read his autobiography, and he is making the same speech in 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010. It's just the sort of the names of the bad people have changed.
Yeah, and the trouble is that when the wall went down in 1989. And Francis Fukuyama talked famously about the end of history. Essentially, that a combination of lightly regulated capitalism and liberal democracy was kind of here to stay, and there was an inevitable, there was inevitability about that. Not only being the system of choice in Western countries, but something the world would inevitably move towards. And that looks quite unlikely today. It's under threat in Western democracies in a way it's never been before in that period. And it's not proved the route to development that a lot of poorer countries have chosen. And I think this goes back to, we need to understand better how it is that markets work, understand that social context. The view of markets that's become dominant is one, as I described it, selfish people being allowed to do more or less whatever they like. That's both repellent to most thoughtful people, and it's also false as a description of how markets really operate.
Yes, I mean there's actually an argument, isn't there? The market is oddly one of the most ethical things, because what you're doing, you know, what you're doing is trusting other people. You are trusting, you know, Britain is trusting that other countries will grow the food and sell it the food so that we don't need to be self-sufficient. You know, you are trusting that when you buy something from Amazon, it will be sent to you by the other person. You know, the whole thing, you know, and there's all sorts of statistics that are showing that, you know, in countries where people don't trust each other, they are poorer because of it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in these kind of Transparency International or World Values surveys, there's a very clear correlation between levels of trust and levels of prosperity. Very clear correlation between, inverse correlation between levels of corruption and prosperity. It's where you become well off by doing things that are valuable to other people rather than by taking money from them, that you become rich. And in many poorer countries, market economies fail because they're essentially kleptocracies, both private and public. In Western economies, it's more subtle, but the rise of rent-seeking behavior across the West is one of the numerous obstacles to the effective functioning of a market economy. And that's something that was well illustrated by the banking system. We've acquired a system of trading that is really an incubus on the market economy, a cost that it has to bear. And it almost fell apart in 2008.
So you'd favour the separation of the casino and the...
Absolutely, you're right. It's a powerful metaphor, and one that is, I think, essential. And the casino activities, they wouldn't disappear altogether, and it's not desirable that they should disappear, because some sort of speculative gambling, bluntly, type activity can help stabilise markets. But actually, when the bulk of market activity becomes speculative gambling of that kind, which is what has been true for the last 20 years, then that's destabilising, not stabilising. And that's what we learned in 2008.
But presumably, these views haven't been terribly fashionable at various points.
No, there is no nuanced account or no widely understood nuanced account of how it is that markets work. So you have a polarization between neoliberalism on the one hand and Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders on the other.
So I mean, I'm just interested to hear you talk about this sort of social and sort of almost moral component, because of course you're from a Scottish background,
yes.
I think, and there's obviously a very, very long tradition of sort of moral philosophy in Scotland, of people thinking about, actually, you know, you could lump in Gordon Brown, you know, people who think about the market but also think about how to use the market as a social good.
Yeah, I guess that's right, and it goes right back to Adam Smith, who's now, for many people on the far right, most of whom haven't read a word that Adam Smith actually wrote, is regarded as this bastion of extreme liberalism.
And in a kind of in a curly wig.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, there are two big points to be made. One is, if you read much of The Wealth of Nations, far less as other books like Theory of Moral Sentiments,
where the clues kind of
you write the clues in the title. Yes, he understood how important social relations were to governing behaviour and indeed to economic behaviour. And also you realise, of course, that the kind of economy he was writing about in 1776 was very different from the kind of economy we have in 2017.
Yes, I mean, if you actually go back and look at what Margaret Thatcher said, you know, she combined this sort of messianic belief in markets with a very sort of powerful moral case.
I think that's right, and I can't imagine that she would have felt comfortable on the trading floor of an investment bank, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, she had to be, actually, I think she had to be persuaded about Big Bang, because she always liked the entrepreneurs, but she was, you know, the sort of the Jimmy Goldsmith types with who were kind of going around doing big deals, but she wasn't so keen on the sort of traditional fusty.
And looking back on it, Big Bang was, it wasn't actually, it would be too simple to say it was a mistake. And there had to be big changes in the regulation of our financial system, if only to cope with what had become a globalized world. But equally in particular, I think the big undesirable effect of Big Bang was that we allowed financial conglomerates to come into being that encompassed a whole range of financial activities, which had previously been prevented by insistence on siloing different activities, so that home loans were made by building societies and banks ran our current accounts and insurance companies provided insurance and so on. And that created both a more stable financial system and one that was better adapted, was better at focusing on the needs of underlying users for financial services.
But I mean, on that, there's an argument which I've heard, which is that the banking model we have at the moment is dying off anyway. That the various functions of the traditional big bank are being sort of disrupted or taken by others. You know, you can get a bank account now from Tesco. You can do loans via other. You know, all of these functions are being.
That's true, but in some ways it's not true enough. And one of the malign effects of regulation is actually that it tends to freeze existing structures. So the truth is, banks almost as we've known them, and certainly as they have become, are dysfunctional institutions. But regulatory pressures operate to keep them in being. We put a lot of effort into making it easier for people to set up new banks. But the price of setting up a new bank is it has to look very like an existing bank.
And it's not just banks. I mean, there's a whole. I mean, that is one of the sort of hidden things in the economy is just how hard it is to set up a construction firm or a solicitors or a, you know, a taxi firm, as we're seeing recently.
And this is partly this. Well, it's largely the story of rent seeking, by which established industries and lobbies are able to use political power to secure entrenched positions for themselves. And at one end of the spectrum, we see that in the political power of investment banks. At the other end of the spectrum, we see it in the political power of traditional taxi drivers.
So if you were magically appointed Chancellor, or Chancellor and Prime Minister, with a solid...
with a dictatorial...
With a Tony Blair-sized majority, I mean, what would your sort of top five... fixes be?
You know, it's funny, before I was appointed Prime Minister and King and dictator and so on, I think I would like to go through the kind of educational process that we're starting to talk about, because we need to build up a constituency for this kind of market economy, to say that our economy does depend very heavily on morality, on trust relationships, on acceptance of the legitimacy of the structure of property rights, and so on. It's not a matter of leaving people alone to do whatever they like, and it's certainly not a matter of glorifying greed or believing that money is the overwhelmingly dominant human motivation. It's not. It's a motivation. It's a perfectly proper motivation, but it's, for the vast majority of people, it's not an exclusive motivation. And the people who, for whom it is an exclusive motivation, actually, are kind of pathological people who ought not to be in charge of any important activities.
Yes, I mean, one of my friends once spent some time researching psychopathic tendencies on trading floors and looking at personality profiles to see whether they could find any correlations. I'm not quite sure what happened.
Well, but he did, yes.
The end results were. But yeah, I mean, it's because yes, I mean, the purpose of the market is not the profits that are made from it; it's the value that it.
Yes, that's right, and profit comes along the way. That's a fundamental point, which and the era of shareholder value, I think, has done a great deal of damage and has, in the end, undermined the legitimacy of business activity in a very real way. And, you know, companies aren't there to make profits. Companies can't succeed unless they do make profits. But the social function of companies is to produce the goods and services we all want, to motivate their employees. And if they do these things, they will make profits. And that's the logic of the market economy. And it's a powerful logic, and when operating properly, is extremely effective.
And actually, so we're ping-ponging about a bit, but you, I think it was in 2012, was it? You actually carried out a review for the government of short-termism and long-termism in the financial markets, but also, you know, what the purpose of the financial markets should be. I mean, do you think that had much impact? Or?
Yeah, it's interesting. And when I did that work, and then when I went on afterwards to write the book Other People's Money that I published in 2015, I told people when I was writing that book that the object of the book was to ask what a financial system would look like if it was designed to meet the needs of users. And the number of people, both inside and outside the financial system, who said, particularly inside the financial system, who said, oh, that's a novel way of looking at it, was very large. And it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, if you talked about another industry in a similar way, people would have said, of course, that's the only interesting question. In the purpose of Tesco and Sainsbury's, to see how they serve their customers and how they can make profits by serving their customers. But they know that the way in which they do make profits is actually by serving their customers better, and that's the power of the market.
Whereas in the finance industry, you've got, you know, PPI, the whole series of sort of, you know, what the crash uncovered, but also since then, is that if companies were profiting by making, you know, Barclays, for example, it set up its own, you know, its own dot, its own pool of, you know, its own pool for people, so that they wouldn't get ripped off by the high frequency traders, and then it allowed a high frequency trader to basically skim off the.
I mean, a lot of that was like supermarkets licensing pickpockets to go around their stores. It's quite extraordinary that you would think these were reasonable things to do.
Or else you sort of see a customer walking down the aisle with a sort of a fat wallet of money, and you quickly send someone out to double the price of the smoked salmon.
And that's a good analogy, because there are a whole load of practices that people quite reasonably think are illegitimate in a market economy, and that you should raise the price when you see someone with a lot of money coming is not a, and it's just not appropriate behaviour, because it undermines the whole kind of social acceptance and trust on which a properly functioning market economy operates.
Although
we keep coming back to that point, but it's so fundamental.
Although there's an interesting question then about what happens in the internet economy when you've got, you know, Amazon doesn't have to show me the same price it has to show you.
No, I know that, and I remember, I just found it an interesting exercise, trying to book an airline ticket in the United States, and I found that the price depended on what computer you logged in from and whether you'd logged in before for that particular flight. Now, some of that is yield management is quite useful. You know, the ways in which airlines are now able to know enough about what's going on to be able to discount prices when the flights are going to be empty, and push them up when they're going to be full. And in the end, we will benefit from that kind of sensitivity of prices to demand. But that's very different from treating your customers on the basis that the question I'm asking is, how much can I rip them off for? Because if you're a business that is there to make profits by serving its customers, you want your customers to trust you, value, and keep coming back. And the sad thing over the last decade or two, particularly in the financial system, but by no means confined to the financial system, is the extent to which consumers have been mistreated in these kind of ways, that their loyalty has been exploited rather than rewarded.
So it's interesting hearing you talk about this, because most people think about there's a line in one of your books, I think, that when you tell people that you're an economic, when you're an economist, they ask you what's going to happen to exchange rates, and then you say, I'm not that kind of economist, and then they turn around and talk to the person next to them.
Yeah, well, it's right when you say you're an economist, they ask you what's going to happen, while looking around to see whether there's a more interesting person to talk to on the other side. And the thing is, they ask you what's going to happen without any real interest in the answer or expectation that you will know the answer. In fact, I've usually found the best way of dealing with that question is to say, so what do you think either is going to happen or should happen? It's interesting, and it's perhaps a demonstration of how ineffectual economics has been, that most people think it's perfectly legitimate to have opinions about economics. You know, if I were to say I was a physicist, I would not expect my neighbour to give me a lecture on physics.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To say that you just write about markets, it would do you a massive disservice. I mean, in The Truth About Markets, actually, I remember there's a section which has completely stayed with me. Whenever I'm writing about government policy, which is on the fast breeder reactors, Britain's first generation of nuclear power programs, where you sort of point out that, you know, for at least the first 20 years of this program, the economically sensible decision would have been to just drop
wipe
it.
Wipe off you, the money.
You call it the worst economic decision ever made by an advanced state, or the worst kind of single project ever carried out by an advanced state.
I think Hinkley Point rivals it, which shows that we don't learn very much in these areas. And that is actually very depressing. It's the weakness in this area of state activity. Firstly, the reason it was possible for that appalling group of projects to take place in the way it did, very interestingly, was that it happened in the public sector and it was covered up. And really, we only learnt the truth about the nuclear program, or the whole of the truth about the nuclear program, when the industry was privatised. And it's a depressing fact that people would lie to Parliament about the progress of these projects, but were unwilling to lie in a stock exchange prospectus, which was why, in the end, the nuclear element had to be pulled out of the privatisation of the electricity companies.
But it ties in, actually, oddly, with the stuff that Corbyn and McDonnell are talking about, because they're saying nationalisation is great. You know, it'll be managed by self-interest, by selfless public servants in the selfless public interest, with local even with local democratic control of the utilities. And you know, what you sort of pointed out then is what you end up with is people saying, oh, we need a national champion in this industry, and we're just going to, we can't just adopt other people's technology. We need a British solution to this problem.
That's right. And, I talk in The Truth About Markets about the merits of what I call disciplined pluralism. And pluralism means, since we don't know very much about the future, we just have to try lots of different things. And discipline means that when things don't work, you stop doing them. And the great advantage of the market is that
That's what it does. Tesco introduces an extra value range and a finest range.
And it either works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And most experiments don't work. But that's fine, so long as you abandon the ones that do. And the trouble with so many public sector projects has been the absence of either pluralism or discipline. It's done by people who believe they know the right thing. And then even if it turns out to be the wrong thing.
Well, this is something. So I was talking to David Laws about this, and he was sort of, he's now founded a think tank on education, which is its explicit goal is to be the IFS of the education industry, to find out what works and what doesn't. And I said to him, hang on, how can you be saying that you're setting up the IFS of the education industry when you just said we're bringing in a pupil premium for everyone in the country, we're bringing in free school meals for everyone in the country? I mean, there was no attempt to say let's bring in a pupil premium in this part of the country and not in this part of the country
and see if
bring in free school meals, let's vary the levels and let's see what works and then roll it out from there.
It's interesting, one of the great political disasters of the modern era was the poll tax. That was introduced in Scotland a year early, proved to be a disaster, and it didn't have the slightest effect on the determination to introduce it across the whole country a year later.
Although it did destroy the Conservative Party in Scotland until Ruth Davidson came along.
You think that of a benefit? It may be.
Well, I'm just making the observation.
It certainly meant you get punished for it, that's right.
What I wanted to do is actually just go back to the start and ask sort of how you got interested in this stuff in the first place. I mean, what... Was it just something that you were always into, or a parent or a teacher, or when you were at university?
No, not at all. I mean, when I was at school, it was in the days before economics was widely taught in schools anyway, but I'd never really heard of economics at school. And I was lucky enough to go to university in Edinburgh. I went to university to read maths because kind of if you were good at school, at maths at school, or if you're good enough at maths at school to go on to do maths, that was what you did. And then two things happened. One was one of the things in Scotland is that you have this tradition by which, firstly, you have to do subjects outside your main specialism for a year or two. And I chose economics as one of them. And there's another Scottish tradition. I don't know if it still applies, that it's kind of the senior professor who teaches the introductory course, or at least begins it. And there was a rather inspirational lecturer called Sandy Youngson who did that. And I thought this is really interesting. And like most people think about economics, I thought it was about how growth and inflation and these big macro issues. But I discovered the nitty-gritty of microeconomics, firms and industries and so on, was, for me at least, more interesting than the macro stuff. And it was also easier, I thought, to get to answers than was true of the macro stuff. So that's been, that was how I became an economist. And then, well, you described right at the beginning how in 1975 Mervyn and I were approached by IFS to help with this project on tax reform. That was the first time I'd taken any interest in tax, but it turned out to be quite a large part of my life after that.
It's because the two of you co-wrote a book, which in a series of editions on the British tax system and what it should become.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting because Mervyn and I have come back to that.
I was going to say, you're co-writing a book.
Yes. Firstly, we've been looking back on that era. We spent a day together at the National Archives a couple of weeks ago, looking through the Treasury and Inland Revenue, as it was, responses to the work that was being done then, which was quite an interesting experience.
You said you were doing two things with Mervyn King. One was looking back at your old stuff, and one is...
One is new stuff. We're writing a book together on the idea of radical uncertainty. In some sense, the provocation is, why we were we so at sea in relation to the financial crisis. And part of that is people believing they understand the environment in which they're operating much better than they actually do. And that was true both for people in commercial banks and for people in central banks up to that time. So by radical uncertainty, we're talking about effectively what Rumsfeld famously called unknown unknowns, things that you don't just don't know, but you don't know them.
So sort of black swans, or is that the...
The black swans. A lot of people have mistaken black swans for improbable events, but that's not what the metaphor is intended to mean or does mean. The point of the black swan was that people believed all swans were white until they encountered a black swan in Australia.
Where would this sort of apply now, I guess? Because it's obviously quite easy to look back and say, this was the problem that no one recognised in 2008. But are you sort of diagnosing areas where you think
it goes much more widely than that. It goes right... the underlying thesis has become that the scope of probabilistic type reasoning and the models that are based on that has been wildly exaggerated. One of the really interesting things we discovered, actually, is that the whole mathematics of probability was only developed in the 17th century, which seems extraordinary because, for example, the Greeks gambled quite a lot. There were people in ancient Greece who were no slouches as mathematicians. And the maths of probability isn't very difficult, as maths goes. And what's happening there is it's not just that people don't have the mathematical tools of probability. They don't even think about probabilities until the 17th century. The future is in some sense determinate. It's defined by the will of the gods for most people, but you don't know what it is. And that's why you do things that now seem to us ludicrous, like consulting the entrails or something. They believe that you will get closer to understanding the will of the gods if you do these kind of things. So that we found a quote, for example, from Gibbon, historian of the Roman Empire. This is even in the 18th century, where he says about Hannibal crossing the Alps, the account of Livy has more of probability. Livy's is the classic story we all know about the elephants and so on, while that of Polybius is more of truth. And that's, to modern ear, that's a very puzzling remark. But what it means is that the account of Livy was the one which was accepted by right-thinking people, which was different from it being true. And that's where people were until then. Now, we've come to the conclusion, actually, that the reason probabilistic reasoning wasn't used for a very long time and why most people still find it difficult is that it's not actually all that useful. And people actually don't cope with uncertainty by thinking probabilistically. They think in terms of narratives, stories. They tell each other stories about the future, and they adjust these narratives, but they don't hold multiple narratives in their minds at the same time.
Yes, so there's this very weird thing where every year, twice a year until recently, but now every year, the Chancellor stands up and says, I can announce that the OBR has has consulted the entrails or used very powerful computers to, and it kind of exclusively reveal that our GDP growth in 2022 will be 2.3%, down from 2.4%. In 2023, it will be 1.8%, up from 1.3%. You know, and then when you actually look at the charts they're doing on these, there's like a vast fan of probabilities, you know, ranging from plus 8% to minus 2%. And then actually, when you look at what ends up happening, it's completely different.
It's likely to be outside that range, I know. You know, firstly, you are never going to be able to predict that growth in 2022 will be 2.3%. In fact, even after 2022, you won't really know what growth has been in 2023. So we just can't have that kind of knowledge. And instead of saying, I really need to know this, we need to say, we can't know this. And how do we manage in a world in which we don't?
Well, for example, you know, there is a forecast of what the public finances will look like in 2080. I'd say, and as which says we will have a crippling amount of debt if we carry on doing all the things we're doing. And actually, as Andrew Scott, who's a scientist of longevity, has pointed out, this is based on the assumption that longevity will not carry on increasing at the same rate that it has.
So that's, well, of course, it's very interesting that longevity has, for the first time, started to decline again. And people haven't really noticed that. It's been true in the United States, it's also been true in Europe.
I have to correct you on that. It's the longevity hasn't started to decline. It's the rate of increase has stopped, if you see what, has gone down, if you see what I mean. I think it's worse than that. I think it's uncertain.
We don't have enough data yet to really know, but something has clearly happened.
Yeah, no, so the interesting thing, because I spent a couple of days looking into this, the interesting thing is in the US, it is due to a particular demographic that is just this kind of the deaths of despair, the opioid epidemic, white working class Americans, you know, that kind of tranche of, you know, the middle-aged men shut out of the job market. It's that kind of, and they have suffered so much that it's dragging everyone else down. Whereas in the UK, the leading hypothesis is actually it's due to pressures on the NHS, and social care, just the fact that, you know, there just isn't as much TLC to go around because it's sort of happening across society, but it's also happening, you know, more so for the elderly. So it's a very interesting thing, but it doesn't seem to be driven by the same. Sorry,
We also know that medical expenditures don't have a great effect on mortality rates.
Yeah, or rather, the cost of keeping people alive for longer scales in an unfortunate fashion.
And the basic point is absolutely right. We are just in this business of pretending to know things we can't possibly know. The example I use a lot, and it is absolutely absurd, is that there's a model used by the Department of Transport called WebTag. And if you're talking about a transport project in the UK that's going to get government money, you have to use this model to appraise it. Now, quite literally, in that model, there are numbers for what the average car occupancy will be in 2036, between 4 and 7 o'clock on Friday evenings. You can get the predicted growth rate of the UK economy in 2080 to 2 decimal places. And all of this is just absurd. So all these numbers have just been made up. And, you know, the average number of passengers in a car in 2036 may well be less than one as things are going.
So how do you fix that? How do you?
We're not going to know these things, so we don't pretend we do. We say we're trying to build strategies that are robust to a whole variety of alternative futures. We try and create organisations that can respond to different challenges in future. I very much like the story. Steve Jobs is regarded as this great visionary of the computer industry. And that's right and wrong. What is right is that Jobs saw, first of all, that to make personal computers take off, you had to construct a computer that you didn't need to understand computers to use. And that's a stroke of genius. And there was a replication of that genius in the incredibly user-friendly devices that Apple had produced. But when Jobs went back to Apple in 1997, he was asked by Dick Rumelt, who was my favorite business strategy guru, as it were. Rumelt asked him, "So what are you going to do now you're back in charge of Apple?" And Jobs said, "I'm going to wait for the next big thing." And actually, 2 years later, the next big thing became music, when downloading of music started to be easy and cheap, and the music publishers screwed up by trying to suppress it. And that led to the iPod. And then the other big thing that was happening was SMS messaging was taking off. So that was the start of what we think of now as social media. And then the next great stroke of genius was to put these things together in the smartphone. So you got that, as it were, combined the iPod and the phone. There wasn't a market for smartphones in 1997 because no one had thought of what a smartphone was in 1997. And that's fundamental to understanding the nature of entrepreneurship. It's interesting, if you go back to what we're talking about when we're talking about radical uncertainty is this difference between risk and uncertainty. And the person who expressed that most clearly is a guy called Frank Knight, who was, in many ways, founder of the Chicago School of Economics. And he made that distinction between risk, that is things you can express probabilistically, and uncertainty, which is things you can't. And he realized that the existence of that distinction is fundamental to entrepreneurship, because it's an uncertainty that gives entrepreneurs like Jobs the opportunity. And if you could define anything probabilistically, there'd really be nothing for an entrepreneur to do.
Which sort of ties in back in with your, so it all ties in with your point about disciplined pluralism, about making bets.
And that's the fundamental dynamic of the market economy. Now, what's interesting in the way in which economics evolved was it rejected this distinction between risk and uncertainty, so that Milton Friedman, who was, as it were, Knight's successor as the leader of the Chicago School of Economics, Friedman would write that Knight made distinction between risk and uncertainty. "I do not follow this distinction because I do not believe it is valid. We can treat people as if they attach probabilities to every possible event." And that statement...
The homo economicus in some ways.
Yeah, that's part of what homo economicus is assumed to do. And that actually, that assumption lies behind with almost all the finance theory that has been developed, and a good deal of the macroeconomic theory that has been developed since then, much of it from Chicago. I mean, the finance theory we use today actually originated in Chicago in the 1950s and 60s. And it was essentially the so-called rational expectations revolution in the 1970s that has come to dominate a lot of modern macroeconomics. And of course, it was that financial economics and that kind of macroeconomics that was shown to be so inadequate in the crisis of 2008.
Yes. So you and Mervyn are attempting to overturn...
To overturn that particular aspect of essentially modern economic reasoning.
So, one final question, and it's a very, very broad one. I mean, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? I mean, everyone these days seems to be leaning towards the pessimistic side of...
I think I am pessimistic, too. In the kind of challenges we have now, strikingly, in British and American politics, are, really the threats to stable democratic structures of the kind we've understood. In a sense, it seems to me the main political axis now is a liberal authoritarian axis rather than a traditional left and right one. And in that sense, one can see that, as it were, Trump and Corbyn, although they could hardly be more different characters, are, in a sense, manifestations of the same phenomenon. And in many ways, Theresa May is a natural authoritarian figure too, just not a terribly effective one, I'm afraid. I think one other, since one regarded the election of Macron in France as very encouraging, but even he seems to have rather strong authoritarian leanings as his performance in the Elysee Palace emerges.
But you won't be joining a new liberal centre party, should one appear.
I'm not going to join any political party, but I think we need a new centre party of some kind.
John Kay, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.